From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In 1951, the actor Spencer Tracy was in New York shooting some final scenes for a film. In his biography of Tracy, James Curtis writes about how most of the actors had gotten the flu, so Tracy goes for a walk. He goes to Mass at St. Patrick's, wanders through Central Park, and at some point the producer of a radio show asked him if he would do a guest shot. "Radio is the bane of my life," Tracy told him. "I can't stand in front of that blankety-blank stick and emote." Spencer Tracy didn't like to talk about his acting technique. He maintained he didn't really know much about how it was done. "You just do it," he said. Today in the program, we're talking about the acting of Spencer Tracy and some other stories as well. James Curtis will join us to walk us through his remarkable career and his remarkable life. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're profiling one of the great actors of a generation. We're talking about Spencer Tracy. James Curtis has produced an epic biography of Tracy. In it, he explores his rich life on film and on the stage. The story, of course, includes this conflicted relationship with Katharine Hepburn and, of course, his devotion to his wife, Louise, whom he never did divorce. This may have be explained by his deep Catholicism. A lot of what we'll talk about today is Spencer Tracy's craft, a technique of acting that is almost impossible to measure. His friend and the actor James Cagney says it was easy to imitate him, but you couldn't imitate Spencer Tracy. He said you can't mimic reserve and control. James Curtis is a biographer who's written about W.C. Fields. He's written about Preston Sturges, about the English director James Whale. He's currently working on a book about the art director William Cameron Manzies, and his book on Spencer Tracy is called Spencer Tracy, A Biography. He's joining us from the studios of Southern California Public Radio in Pasadena. James Curtis, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Doug.
Well, I guess the obvious question, first of all, but let me begin by asking you, when you first started thinking about Spencer Tracy, and maybe thinking about that you might want to write about Spencer Tracy, what did you know about the man in the early days?
I think I knew what most of the general public knows. I knew about the relationship of Katharine Hepburn. I knew a lot of his work. I was long fascinated with his work, going back to when I saw Inherit the Wind on television in the mid-1960s. And I knew a lot about his drinking. And beyond that, I didn't know a lot about him. I also was aware of the John Tracy Clinic here in Los Angeles. And so I wanted to know basically what the real story was, because the legend that had come to take root didn't explain a lot of things, and that was the thing that ultimately drove me. I wanted to know what was behind it, and in doing so, I found out a lot of what the popularly held image of him conveyed was wrong in most cases. In other cases, it was awfully it was an awfully complicated truth that existed beneath the cliche. And so all of this was an attempt ultimately to understand him better and understand the times in which he lived.
You asked Spencer Tracy's daughter, Susie, if she would help cooperate early on. And at first she said no, or she wasn't sure she was interested early on. But then I guess she reconsidered, and you write about earlier in the book how you had this really long lunch with Susie Tracy and the producer and a lifelong Tracy friend, William Self. What did you guys talk about at that lunch?
Well, we talked about really why there was a need for such a book and how I would approach it. Mm-hmm. And I told Susie at that point that I wanted to write a completely truthful book. I was not going to color the truth in any way. I remember telling her, as a matter of fact, that if I find out that he killed the Black Dahlia, I was going to use it. And But she was okay with that. She was not the least bit protective. She loved her father very much, of course, but there were large portions of his life that she was not witness to, and she had heard a lot of contradictory things over the course of her life. She'll be 80 this year. Yeah. And I think she wanted to understand the truth. She wanted to know what really happened. And Bill Self, fortunately, was familiar with my other books. And so he was able to confirm to her that I do serious work. I don't do sloppy, stereotypical movie biographies. And so on that basis, she put her trust in me. She imposed no restrictions of any sort and gave me full access to everything that she had, which included his date books, his private correspondence, etc.
Mm. It's interesting because and we'll talk about his relationship with Katharine Hepburn. You kind of have to when you're talking about Spencer Tracy's life, of course. But
sure.
It's interesting how much of a part of the Katharine Hepburn story Spencer Tracy is. And you hear him connected to her as opposed to standing alone. That seems an important part of what you were trying to do, is kind of disconnect him, at least for a time, from her and talk about him in his own right, I guess.
Absolutely, because in his time, in their time, he was the more major figure by far. She had great ebbs and flows in her career, and one of the great surges in her career took place after his death in 1967. And of course, she managed to outlive him by decades, and so she became a figure of great fascination. She has always been with the American public, and a lot of books were written about Katharine Hepburn, not terribly good books in a lot of cases, but books in which Spencer Tracy was painted in broad strokes. And I don't think Katharine Hepburn in her lifetime was happy about that. And I think she would have wanted him portrayed as realistically as possible as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure she fully understood him, and she said as much.
Yeah.
He was a thing of mystery to her in some ways.
It seems like that she didn't exactly, and we'll talk about this as we go along, but it seems like she was a little unclear about the nature of their relationship, as well as he may have been in some ways. They knew that they had some kind of connection. They knew that they loved each other, but they knew it was complicated. It was unclear. You know, she was such a striking, independent woman, yet in her relationship with Spencer Tracy, it didn't always seem that she played that role. I mean, it's really a complicated dynamic.
It's a terrifically complicated relationship, and all the more complicated when you insert Louise Tracy into the equation. But I think that the thing was that Katharine Hepburn, I think initially when they met and when she solicited him for the film Woman of the Year, which is a project that she had developed herself, it was a follow-on in effect to the Philadelphia story, which had pretty much revived her career in 1940. And she wanted to work with Spencer Tracy badly. And I think also she wanted to sleep with Spencer Tracy. And I don't think she counted on falling in love with him, but that's what ultimately happened, is that she made him a project. And she saw a man who was in rough shape psychologically. He was drinking heavily. And she had a natural nurturing instinct, which I guess came to some degree from coming from a family of medical doctors. Her brother was a doctor, father was a doctor. And I think she had that gift, that instinct in her. And she saw herself as somebody who could move into the situation and, in effect, save this man. And I think it's indisputable that he lived longer than he would have without her.
Yeah. Of course, we can't tell the story about Spencer Tracy without exploring Louise Treadwell, which you say early on in her life. I mean, she could have been a journalist. She could have, you know, been a novelist. She could have published some of her poems. Apparently, she was quite good at that. But all she wanted to do, you say, was be an actress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was really struck by the theater from an early age. She was apparently a very, very good actress. We have very little of her on film. She was primarily a stage actress. She did some Broadway, but for the most part, she was in American stock, Grand Rapids particularly, but she was with companies all over the country. She was a leading woman, and she played Chautauqua. She did a lot of things, and she was older than he was, so that when they got together initially, he was straight out of drama school, and she was by far the more experienced of the two.
Talk about his experience, as you say, coming out of drama class. What was the technique that was being used on, I guess, on film, but in particular, and at least in this context right now, on the stage? What was the technique that was being used? Because it was something that really didn't work for Spencer Tracy. He didn't find it real enough or something.
It was very broad, and I suppose you could say Victorian. The regional stage of that time was not a reserve of subtlety. This was stuff that was playing to sometimes very unsophisticated audiences. That's especially true in Chautauqua. But actors worked with nose putty and crepe hair, and they built whatever characters they could build from without. You started with the face, you started with the posture, you started with the costume, and then worked inward as much as you could, given whatever talent or gift you had in that way. I think that it was tough on actors also because of the way stock worked. I mean, you had a new play to perform every week. So on a given day, you were rehearsing next week's play. That evening, you were performing the current play, and at the same time, you were forgetting last week's play.
Right.
So some actors, obviously a lot of actors who didn't make it to the big time, they in a lot of cases had a limited toolbox to call upon and perhaps not too much in the way of training. Tracy had figured out early on how to internalize a character. He worked from within, in the sense that the method later taught. He was in some ways one of the original method actors, but it came to him instinctively. It came to him naturally. And what he found he could do is meld whatever he could bring to a role as an actor with that of the character, the conception of the character in such a way so that he really, as much as possible, rejected the notion of elaborate makeups, or for that matter, loud declamatory style. I mean, he was after a connection with the audience on a much more visceral level, and I think that distinguished him. It made him more admirable to some audiences and less interesting to others who are interested in the more traditional approach, the broader approach, the more popular approach. Mm. But as it turned out, what made him so interesting and compelling on stage eventually made him perfect for the talking screen.
Mm. It's hard to we'll talk more about this guy because I have to say I think that the idea of Spencer Tracy's technique is the most elusive concept out there in some ways. And you spend a lot of time with it. And in many ways, the book is about not just a figure, not just a father or a husband or lover, but it's about an actor. In some ways, it's almost as much about that as anything else.
Thank you. I'm glad you see that because it was indeed an actor's biography. It would have cheated the reader quite a bit if it was simply a movie star biography because he didn't make his first movie until he was 30 years old and he only lived to be 67. So half his life was practically over when he stepped before a camera. So there's a great deal. And, it's not as if we're dealing with a minor figure like, Sonny Tufts, for instance, but we're dealing with one of the great American actors of his time, if not the greatest. And he's a figure that merits that kind of inquiry, that kind of in-depth look. And we had the chance to do that, and that's why we chose to do it as we did, and that's why the book is, frankly, as long as it is, because every single theme that we could bring to bear was worth exploring because so much of what he did and so much of the impact he had came from within, and it was a very complicated internal set of tools and capabilities that he called upon, and some of which I think he didn't understand himself, but he was able to pull that power.
James Curtis is with us. He's the author of Spencer Tracy, a biography. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the biographer James Curtis. We're talking about his book, Spencer Tracy, a biography. Well, so Spencer Tracy works on the stage for years and years. And as you said, he was 30 years old when he has his first big hit really on Broadway. It's The Last Mile. I guess it's at this point that the great director John Ford sees Spencer Tracy.
Yeah, he was in New York. He was scouting for a prison film. Everybody was making prison films. And the big one that MGM had produced was called The Big House. And so Fox, at that time being the outfit that they were, well, let's produce a copy, in other words. Let's do one of our own. And they assigned it to John Ford, who was one of their contract directors at that time. And he determined that he wanted to use some new actors. He didn't want any established people in it. And so he went to New York scouting. And naturally, the first thing that he went to see on the first night in town was the Last Mile, which was the big prison play of the moment, and he was so taken with Spencer Tracy that he arranged to meet with him afterwards. Went back, actually, I think he said 3 or 4 times to see the same play, and he determined that Tracy had to be in his film, and Tracy had already been tested by Fox, and they had rejected him. Yeah. And the point being that he didn't look good in makeup, and Ford said, well, he's not going to wear any makeup in my film. And so Tracy was sent out to California, and he got a good solid tan, and that enabled him to film without makeup. And so he made his first film without makeup, and he proceeded to make most of his films without makeup.
This was up the river, I guess.
Yes.
Which is extraordinary for I guess, a few reasons. First film for Spencer Tracy. But he also makes his debut with Humphrey Bogart, which is amazing.
That was his first film also.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there's a scene I want to just – there's nothing terribly extraordinary here about the acting except for the novelty of hearing Humphrey Bogart and Spencer Tracy acting. This was, again, another – they were popular genre at the time, prison film from the film Up the River. With we'll hear Spencer Tracy here in Humphrey Bogart.
Hey, buddy, I'm sorry. I butted into something. I didn't know. She don't want to see me. She wants to see you.
Me?
Yeah. Say, I didn't know that you two were fond of each other.
Oh, gee, I don't know how fond she is of me, but I think she's a fine girl.
Well, ain't you never said anything to her?
No, I haven't had a chance. You know what the rules are. Oh, wait. A couple of times in the windows.
Well, you come on over. I'd like to have you meet her.
Yeah, but listen, if she's caught talking
to
me, you know...
don't let that worry. I'll take care of all that.
So what did... this wasn't the greatest role of all time, but Spencer Tracy's sort of... I'm stuck anyway. He moved from Fox to MGM, of course. How did he keep getting attention? He's a pretty unassuming figure in many ways.
Well, and he didn't get a lot of attention the first few years he was out here in California because he was stuck at Fox and they didn't know what to do with him. I think the reason they didn't let him go, because he was a problem at that time. He was a binge drinker. And so he would disappear from time to time, and that would create trouble with their scheduling, of course. But the head of production at Fox was a man named Winfield Sheehan. And unlike most of the executives in Hollywood at that time, he was a Roman Catholic. And so Tracy, I think, in some ways appealed to him because they were of a like background. And so Sheehan, I think, Tracy in effect was Sheehan's pet, but also Tracy was just awfully good at what he did. And even in the most melodramatic and simplistic stuff that they would put him in, and he was making 3 or 4 feature films a year when he wasn't being lent out, he made an impression. He registered with people. But he really wasn't an attraction. People generally didn't go to the films to see Spencer Tracy until he moved to MGM, and they finally had an idea of what to do with him. MGM was set up to develop talent. Fox was not. And so Tracy was brought over to MGM at the behest of Irving Thalberg, who was a specialist in taking damaged goods from other companies and making them valuable once more. He did that with the Marx Brothers that same year, and he did it with Spencer Tracy. And he knew Tracy's talent. He knew that Tracy was being wasted where he was, and he knew that Tracy would make a tremendous impression where he developed properly. And so that's what they proceeded to do starting in 1935. And by 1938, he had won the first of 2 Oscars for Best Actor.
So what was it? I mean, what was the thing that MGM was able to see that Fox really hadn't, do you think?
Well, several things. MGM had a lot of people under contract, and it was possible to take some of the big female attractions of that period and pair Tracy with them. At Fox, they had people like Faye Ray and Peggy Shannon and people who have not really lasted through the decades. But at MGM, they could pair Tracy with Gene Harlow. They could pair him with Myrna Loy. So there was a lot of talent there. And as he was paired with these women, he was brought up to their level in terms of stature. They also put him with some of the big male stars of the period, most notably Clark Gable in the film San Francisco. But they also knew that Spencer Tracy had a range that really hadn't been explored at Fox. And really, most actors of that period weren't capable of such a range. These were in the days when you had actors that essentially ended up playing variations on themselves over a period of many years. Frank Morgan, for instance, use an example. Clark Gable. He was usually Clark Gable, more or less. Yeah. But Tracy, in the first 16 months or thereabouts that he was at MGM, they had him in San Francisco playing a priest, a very non-traditional priest, I might add. He was in a terrifically intense film directed by Fritz Lang called Fury. They put him in a screwball comedy called Libeled Lady with Gene Harlow and William Powell. And they cast him as a Portuguese fisherman in Captain's Courageous. And it was an astonishing range demonstrated at a time when people weren't used to seeing major actors demonstrate such a range. And I think that made a tremendous impression on people.
The director, Vincent Minnelli, said that Tracy had a way of speaking that made you feel that you had stumbled upon some kind of great truth. And he described it as a kind of inner stillness. That he just was.
That's true.
He would just allow it to happen. How do you explain it? What do you mean?
At the same time, though, you know, there was great power that you sensed within Tracy.
Yeah.
George M. Cohan one time, who thought Tracy was one of the best actors he had ever seen, and George M. Cohan talked about an actor that he admired greatly, and the fact that whatever he gave you as an actor, which was always impressive, you knew that he had more in reserve, that there was more power there that he could call upon if he needed to. And Tracy was like that. He had a tremendous reserve of power. Some of it, I think, came from his own self-loathing. He had a very dark interior, dark core, I should say. But I think he knew how to harness it, at least instinctively, and make a connection through the camera, which was extraordinarily hard to do, and with his fellow actors as well. I mean, one of the things that comes through with even today people who acted opposite him, the few that are left, they remember the eye contact. They remember the intensity behind the eyes. This is stuff you can't fake. And it took an emotional toll on him, I think, to do that because he was called upon to give his best, to give his all, with material that oftentimes was not equal to him, his talent. But he did so. It did, I think, ultimately a certain amount of psychological damage to him. But that's what it took to be Spencer Tracy. That's what it took to register as he did with audiences. And few other actors of his generation were able to do that.
There's a powerful story you tell with Robert Wagner, who was appearing in one of his first films, if not his first films. It was The Mountain, I think it was called. Mm-hmm. And they have a particular scene, and Wagner's trying to act like Spencer Tracy in the sense of kind of underact. And
That's Broken Lance.
Broken Lance.
Broken Lance.
Talk about that, if you would, that moment, because Spencer Tracy really scolds Robert Wagner later for thinking too – I'm not sure what he's getting at, but he scolds him for thinking too much about the technique and not trying to find a kind of inner truth.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. And other actors have told me this as well, young actors who worked with Tracy early on, that they mistook out of misunderstanding. They mistook what he did for just lowering his voice, you know, trying to underplay his scene in a very surface sort of way. And that wasn't what Tracy was doing at all. Tracy was not underplaying so much as he was playing at a level that he felt he himself could make a connection, at first and foremost with the camera and with the audience and with his fellow actor. Tracy had the ability, and I heard this time and again from people who worked with him, he was not acting a part. He was the part. He was the character. And that's the connection. That's the level that he connected with you on. I think that in RJ's case, what he was trying to do was essentially throw away a line that should not be thrown away. And he did not have the technique or the background with which to know how to do that effectively. And Tracy was saying, in effect, dig deeper, know your craft better. And I think RJ would say as much today, that that's what he was after. But Tracy saw something in Robert Wagner that I think brought out paternal instincts, and he kind of took RJ under his wing. And I think whatever success Robert Wagner achieved in later years as an actor, I think goes directly back to his time with Spencer Tracy. Robert Wagner, of course, grew up out here, and he used to caddy on the golf course for Clark Gable. And he ran into Clark Gable after he got the part in Broken Lance and said, "I'm going to work with Spencer Tracy." And Gable's advice was, grab a prop and keep moving, kid.
The director, George Cukor, said that there was a kind of musicality in the way Spencer Tracy approached his work, a kind of rhythm here. Eddie Dimitrik said that Tracy's phrasings were kind of like a jazz singer in some ways.
I thought those comments were very perceptive, because Tracy's an actor. You can take his best performances and you can almost plot them in symphonic terms, that his performances come through in movements, if you will. It's amazing to think of it that way. But if you look at a film like Inherit the Wind or Judgment at Nuremberg and how he carries himself, how he manages a level of continuity, emotional continuity with a scene and with a character and with a film, with a story, that's extraordinary. And I think he had the sensitivities of a musician without perhaps knowing that. But you hear that time and again from the really good directors who worked with him. George Cukor would say that, for instance, that he would Tracy would say after a particularly good scene, "Well, everybody's singing their lyrics well." You know, he thought in those terms to some degree. And any great artist, I think, of which Tracy was certainly one, I think has that component within them. They have a musicality to what they do that communicates, that connects on a visceral level with an audience.
I want to play some of Spencer Tracy acting, and you mentioned Inherit the Wind, so let's talk about that. This was, of course, that dramatization of the Scopes Monkey Trial, that challenge to this Tennessee law that prohibited the teaching of evolution in schools. And Spencer Tracy plays the part of Henry Drummond, which is really Clarence Darrow. This is one of the director Stanley Kramer's boyhood heroes you talk about. He's this passionate Chicago progressive, and Kramer loved him, and Spencer Tracy is extraordinary. But I wonder, what did he think about the character? I mean, here's a liberal progressive, you know, pretty skeptical about religion. What did Spencer Tracy make of that?
Spencer Tracy politically was a Roosevelt Democrat, so he was was in line with the politics of the part. But I think on a more basic level, he's the old wounded warrior who has come to town, ridden in on his horse for one more battle, and he gives that kind of world weary awareness, sophistication, outrage, if you will. And I think that everything that could possibly have been written into that part and into the life and mentality of Clarence Darrow himself comes through in the shadings that Spencer Tracy manages in this film.
Hmm. There's a moment in the film where you say that he's talking to the characters of Burt Cates and Rachel Brown, his fiancée, in this almost empty courtroom. And you talk about this was really Spencer Tracy's first opportunity to come on and really take command of the film. Set this up for us, this particular moment, because I want to play this moment.
That comes from what Marlon Brando said about him, that he was so fascinating in the sense that he knows where he can come on and where he needs to hold back. And you get back to the musicality of a performance in that regard. You can't keep pounding away constantly. You know where you have to lay back, and you see your opportunities to come forward and make the impression, to make the point that you need to make from a character standpoint as well as from an actor's standpoint. And This is that, in that up to this point, the stage has been held by Gene Kelly, who's playing H.L. Mencken, mm-hmm. and the others in the cast. And this is the first point at which Tracy, as Henry Drummond, gets a chance to really show what he's made of in terms of his emotional and ethical commitment to his client, but also how he feels about the situation and his own stand, which is informed of having fought the good battle for unpopular causes for, you know, 40, 50 years perhaps.
They look at me as if I was a murderer.
In a way you are. You know, you kill one of their fairy tale notions and they'll bring down the wrath of God, Brady, and the state legislature on you every time.
You make a joke out of everything.
Young lady, I know what Bert is going through. It's the loneliest feeling in the world. It's like walking down an empty street listening to your own footsteps. But all you have to do is to knock on any door and say, if you'll let me in, I'll live the way you want me to live, and I'll think the way you want me to think. And all the blinds will go up, and all the doors will open, and you'll never be lonely ever again. Now, it's up to you, Kate. You just say the word, and we'll change the plea. And that is, of course, if you honestly believe that the law is right and you're wrong. Now, if that's the case, just tell me, and I'll pack my bag and go back to Chicago, where it's a nice, cool 100 in the shade.
James Curtis, what do you see in that scene? Because that seems influential for you when you're thinking about Spencer Tracy. What do you see when you see that scene?
I see a man who is at one with his character. You can't separate the two of them. And that was the thing that I think struck me so hard when I first saw him in this role. And I think that's what struck me repeatedly in watching the films that he made in later days, because let's face it, he made 75 feature motion pictures, and not all of them are classic material. But he, out of the resume that naturally accrues to a well-paid actor in that period when there was no television, you know, and you ended up making two or three films a year. It was a sausage factory. Not all of them came out well. They weren't supposed to all come out well. But he had an extraordinary percentage of his films that are really, really good and highly regarded today. I mean, Woman of the Year and Adam's Rib and Bad Day at Black Rock and Judgment at Nuremberg. I mean, I can go on and list them. Fury is another one. San Francisco, which is a wonderful piece of work in its own way. Consistently, he elevates the material, and when he gets material that's equal to him, like here with Inherit the Wind, one of the great American plays, he rises to the occasion in such a way that it's magical.
Stanley Kramer, you talk about this particular moment when Stan – I can't imagine trying to direct Spencer Tracy, but you talk about this time when Stanley Kramer – they're going through a scene, and he thinks that Spencer Tracy sort of dropped a line. You couldn't quite hear him. And so he takes a deep breath, and he says, Spencer Tracy says, we couldn't understand a particular line. And Spencer Tracy doesn't take too well to that.
Well, you know, part of the illusion that Tracy creates, it's what Louise Tracy referred to as that natural thing. And he had tricks that he would use to make it seem as if he's thinking of the line right then and there, and little hesitancies and things. But he always knew beneath the surface how to put across a line so that you didn't forget it. He was like, well, a master comedian who knows how to put the punchline across in such a way so the audience might think they've just picked that up and they're in on something somewhat subversive. But in reality, it was placed right over the plate by the actor who knows what he's doing. And Tracy always knew what he was doing. And he needed to train Stanley Kramer, right. I think, in that regard. You know, I know what I'm doing is what he said. And then he kind of backpedaled a bit and said, well, okay, let's do it again. Yeah. But Tracy was playing to the camera and Tracy was playing to the character. And I think Kramer, better than anyone, understood that to the extent that he knew there was no better casting for this part than Tracy. And Tracy validated that impression, believe me.
It must have been amazing being on that set. Kramer shot
it
kind of like it was on a stage. But imagine being an extra, you know, in the courtroom scene. It must have been seeing Frederick March and and Spencer Tracy going at it and these long sequences. It must have been a once-in-a-lifetime experience.
Oh, the actors. I mean, Elliot Reed, who plays the prosecuting attorney in it, he was just marveling. And he had worked with Orson Welles. He worked with everybody. And he was marveling at the ability to be able to sit several feet away from this and watch it as it was going on. And the impression that was created among the cast of this being almost a stage production was in some ways the result of Kramer doing it in very long takes because he knew that both March and Tracy were up to it. And so these long back and forths, which incidentally were taken in many cases directly from the transcript of the original trial, were just fabulous demonstrations of the actor's art, plus 35, 40 years experience in putting material like this across. And it was like a master's class, and everybody was not only thrilled to be part of it, but after every shot there was applause, which you never hear about in the making of films like this. So everybody had an extraordinary time.
Well, let's play one more scene. This is Frederick Marsh playing. You can hear him. He's terrific as Matthew Harrison Brady, of course. And Spencer Tracy, he's Henry Drummond. You know, Gene Kelly, you mentioned, talked about the embodiment of art that conceals art. Like, it was impossible to learn anything from Spencer Tracy because everything he did came deep down from some inner part of himself. And I think you'll get a sense of that from this scene from the film, Inherit the Wind.
I mean, in my own way.
Your Honor. I am willing to sit here and endure Mr. Drummond's sneering and his disrespect, for he is pleading the case of the prosecution by his contempt for all that is holy.
I object, I object, I object.
On what grounds? Is it possible that something is holy to the celebrated agnostic?
Yes. The individual human mind. In a child's power to master the multiplication table, there is more sanctity than in all your shouted amens and holy holies and hosannas. An idea is a greater monument than a cathedral. And the advance of man's knowledge is a greater miracle than all the sticks turned to snakes or the parting of the waters. But now, are we to forego all this progress because Mr. Brady now frightens us with a fable?
From the film Inherit the Wind, that's the great Spencer Tracy. James Curtis is with us. He's the author of the book Spencer Tracy, A Biography. We need to take another break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with James Curtis. We're talking about his book, Spencer Tracy, A Biography. So I wanted to ask you, how did Katharine Hepburn describe their relationship? She told Bill Self once that they can't live together, but they are together. And there seems to be, some sense of whether or not Louise knew about it. I mean, it seems clear that she did, but it seems like Spencer Tracy didn't like to think of the idea that his wife Louise knew, in fact, about this relationship that seems like the whole country knew about.
Yeah, well, the whole company, pretty much imagined it based upon their film work together. It was not something that was encouraged as in terms of an impression by the film companies, primarily MGM. I mean, that would have been an adulterous relationship and one that you don't talk about back then, you didn't talk about back then. Louise Tracy was nobody's fool. I think there was a point at which, however, she emotionally a great deal of damage was done to that marriage by the birth of a deaf son in 1924. And they were not of the same faith. Louise was reared Episcopalian. Spencer was, of course, Irish Catholic. Yeah. Katharine Hepburn was an atheist. And so Tracy carried with him a great deal of embedded guilt that he really couldn't talk about with anyone else except perhaps a fellow Catholic because they wouldn't understand it. But he beat himself up a great deal over things like this, and he compensated for it in elaborate ways. He I think, needed to believe that Louise did not know, simply for not just to save his own hide, which I don't think was really part of his strategy so much as to protect Louise. Mm-hmm. I think he was very conscious, especially after 1942 when she was in charge of the John Tracy Clinic, and they essentially, between the two of them, brought that, willed that place into existence, and it's still here 70 years later. He with his money and her with her her mojo, her rolling up her sleeves and making it happen. But at the time that the boy was born and the deafness was discovered, Louise's natural reaction was, how do I fix this? What can I do about it? Spencer's reaction was more, this is my fault, and I've got to beat myself up over it because I don't know what else to do. And so that, I'm afraid, set the pattern for the marriage. There was still a great deal of need and nourishment between the two of them. That's one of the reasons why they never divorced. But there were whole areas of Spencer's life that Louise, after a while, could not address. And I think that left the opening for the other women in his life, and particularly Katharine Hepburn, who chose to stay.
You write about there is one consistent thing, ritual, I guess, throughout Spencer Tracy's life, and that was Sunday morning mass. And I'm just trying to imagine what it would have been like to have come upon this famous character who was, again, pretty unassuming. And people write about, they would see him there, and he just was quiet. But he was always there on a Sunday morning for the most part, if he could.
Yeah, it was important to him. He took it very seriously. He was talking one time with Eugene Kennedy, who knew him at the end of his life and who was a former priest himself. How would you describe him? And we kind of decided that you could say that he was a visceral Catholic. He was not an intellectual Catholic, but it was in his bones. Mm-hmm. And what he believed is what he believed. He didn't talk about it much. The only thing he ever said to Louise was he couldn't understand why anybody would think there wasn't a God. He didn't understand that at all. But in terms of Catholic dogma, in terms of the faith in which he was reared by his fathers, because his mother was not Catholic either, I think that was a very closely held thing that he could not explain and really, really didn't want to explain. But it's something that guided a great deal of what he did in life. Mm.
Right around about 1958, I guess it is, you talk about in the book that he starts thinking about, all right, I'm too old for this. I'm spent. And he started considering retiring. Of course, he didn't. He didn't really at all. But he's thinking about this, and he comes upon these great scripts. Of course, Inherit the Wind is one. Judgment at Nuremberg, I wanted to ask you about. Mm. Another Stanley Kramer project. This is 1961. And I guess this is another character that he could really believe in.
Yes, indeed. Well, it was good material also. Yeah. It had been done on television, written for television by Abby Mann and done on television by Claude Rains, of all people, and another magnificent actor. And but it was really in the last few years Stanley Kramer's conviction that any time he could put Spencer Tracy on screen was a time of value. It didn't matter whether commercially he wasn't the most popular of actors anymore, and he really wasn't in a lot of ways, although two of his last films became the most popular films of his career. Mm-hmm. But for instance, on Judgment at Nuremberg, the United Artists people wanted James Stewart for that part, who was much more popular at that time. Kramer would not abandon Tracy. He insisted on Tracy as playing that part. It was difficult material that Kramer instinctively put across with a number of name actors. And it's a fascinating film just in terms of the cast. Marlena Dietrich is in it. Judy Garland, Montgomery Clift, Burt Lancaster. Amazing piece of work. Long film, very challenging film. And then you work up to the last few minutes of it. And the summation that Spencer Tracy delivers in one take is remarkable.
Here it is from the movie Judgment at Nuremberg.
But this trial has shown that under a national crisis, ordinary, even able and extraordinary men can delude themselves into the commission of crimes so vast and heinous that they beggar the imagination. No one who has sat through the trial can ever forget them. Men sterilized because of political belief.
a mockery made of friendship and faith, the murder of children. How easily it can happen. There are those in our own country, too, who today speak of the protection of country, of survival. A decision must be made in the life of every nation at the very moment when the grasp of the enemy is at his throat. Then it seems that the only way to survive is to use the means of the enemy, to rest survival upon what is expedient, to look the other way. Well, the answer to that is survival is what? A country isn't a rock. It's not an extension of oneself. It's what it stands for. It's what it stands for when standing for something is the most difficult. Before the people of the world, let it now be noted that here in our decision, this is what we stand for. Justice, truth, and the value of a single human being.
Brings us, James Curtis, to the final film that Spencer Tracy made. Died, just a few weeks after Guess Who's Coming to Dinner in 1967.
17 days.
17 yes. days. Say something about that. I wanted to play an excerpt from that extraordinary speech at the end of the film.
It's to Stanley Kramer, I think, that we owe this last performance from Spencer Tracy, and this most indelible one. Everything indicated that it shouldn't happen. His health was poor. He couldn't be insured. Katharine Hepburn and ultimately Stanley Kramer both waived their salaries in order to ensure that it would be made. And they rescued this performance right from the brink. As I said, he died 17 days after they made the last shot in it. But at the same time, because of the backstory, it's one of the most extraordinary achievements in terms of just getting it made, not just that it was a good film, but that they got it on film at all. Yeah. And it's interesting to point out that this was written by a very fine writer of mostly comedies, William Rose, an American transplanted to England. He had the idea. Kramer embraced it, and it's become really a classic of its kind. And it has an audience as broad today as it ever did. Yeah. I think
this last scene, he's gathered together his daughter and Sidney Poitier, who plays his potential son-in-law, and their parents, and of course Katharine Hepburn there, and he's deciding whether or not he's going to give his blessing to this marriage. I guess that. That sums it up pretty well, you think, James Curtis?
I think so.
Now, Mr. Prentiss, clearly a most reasonable man, says he has no wish to offend me, but wants to know if I'm some kind of a nut. And Mrs. Prentiss says that, like her husband, I'm a burnt-out old shell of a man who cannot even remember what it's like to love a woman the way her son loves my daughter. And strange as it seems, that's the first statement made to me all day with which I am prepared to take issue. Because I think you're wrong. You're as wrong as you can be. I admit that I hadn't considered it, hadn't even thought about it. But I know exactly how he feels about her. And there is nothing, absolutely nothing, that your son feels for my daughter that I didn't feel for Christina. Old? Yes. Burned out? Certainly. But I can tell you, the memories are still there. Clear, intact, indestructible. And they'll be there if I live to be 110. Where John made his mistake, I think, was attaching so much importance to what her mother and I might think. Because in the final analysis, it doesn't matter a damn what we think. The only thing that matters is what they feel and how much they feel for each other. And if it's half of what we felt, that's everything.
Spencer Tracy from Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. Let me ask you this finally. Lived his last years on a cottage on George Cukor's estate once said that he always liked to live in a small place because he lived a small life. What do you remember most about Spencer Tracy, finally?
The mystery of his genius, I think. I think that what a great actor does is always a bit of a mystery, as any great creative artist. You get to a certain point, and then the thing happens, and you're left with a sense of wonderment. And that's ultimately why I take away, even after 6 years' work on this subject, was a sense of wonderment.
Man, I hope people go see his films. Don't you? People who haven't recognized him yet, who haven't, they sort of know of him. I hope hearing some of those scenes today will make them go and rent some Spencer Tracy movies.
I certainly envy them because somebody who's got that body of work ahead of them in terms of being able to see them for the first time, just terrific.
Yeah. James Curtis, his latest book is called Spencer Tracy, A Biography, and he joined us from Southern California Public Radio in Pasadena. James Curtis, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you very much, Doug. I've enjoyed it.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Olivia Davis and to Matthew Martin. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson. The show produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. And I'm Doug Fabrizio.